You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 2nd, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, guys. How you doing?
Well,
good,
hello.
How are you? Rebecca is jet-lagged tonight from traveling too much. She's a jet-setter, this girl. She's always traveling somewhere.
She said in the email that she couldn't keep her eyes open and she was like falling asleep on the couch. And I kind of turned that into her having like four or five beers, like just kind of like,
ah. All right, so Evan, you're back to your old job as This Day in Skepticism.
October 5th every year is World Teachers Day, a day in which we celebrate the qualities of teachers around the world for everything that they do. You know, obviously education, recruitment of teachers, promotion of better learning conditions for teachers. Teachers play such an important, vital role, an obvious role in our society that it's wholly appropriate, I think, that an entire day is dedicated to them and acknowledging all of their contributions to education around the world. However, it does fall on a Saturday this year, so I'm not quite sure, you know, what people are going to do about that. They can't exactly
celebrate the actual day. They always do it on the following Monday, right? If it's a week.
Yeah, the following Monday. Yep.
Well, happy World Teacher Day to all those teachers out there. Hey, did you guys hear that the new Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their latest report on global warming?
95%.
Yeah, so big news.
That's the consensus
is,
now? It's 95% consensus?
Well, the last report, the consensus is pretty thorough. I mean, this was the consensus statement of the committee. The committee involves 209 lead authors, 50 review editors from 39 countries, and more than 600 contributing authors from 32 countries in the working group that reviewed the world's literature on climate change and came up with a number of consensus conclusions or interpretations about that evidence. The bottom line is that they upgraded their confidence interval. So last time they came up with the report, they said they're 90% sure that humans are causing global warming. Now they upgraded that to 95%. So more confident than ever that anthropogenic global warming is happening.
Isn't that in a strange way, though, good news? Because that means that we could reverse it?
Well, I guess it's how you
not
look at it.
Necessarily.
It means that our climate models are telling us something, you know, reliable. Mm. They also concluded, these are some highlights from their summary. The oceans are storing most of the extra heat, about 90%. Arctic sea ice, Antarctic and Greenland ice caps and glaciers worldwide have all been losing mass. Sea levels are rising. Atmospheric CO2 and methane are at their highest levels in 800,000 years. The CO2 is causing increased atmospheric forcing, raising temperatures, and human influence is clear. They also, however, reduced the lower end of the range of possible temperature increase over the 21st century. So at the lower end was a 2 degree Celsius increase in temperature by 2100. They've lowered that now to 1.5 C. So of course, you know, the global warming skeptics and deniers are all over that. They also are still, you know, they're hitting the same themes that they always have. They're arguing that, you know, because they had to adjust that figure and because of the alleged pause in global warming for the last 15 years, this shows that their climate models don't work or they don't know what they're talking about. So in that respect, you know, they're like evolution deniers, right? They will take disagreements over some detail of evolution as if that calls into question the bigger theory of, you know, is life evolving on this earth? So that's what they're doing. But the broad brushstrokes, the globe is warming. It's due to forcing from, you know, man-made CO2 and methane in the atmosphere. Other sources of the forcing have all been ruled out. 95% confidence in that conclusion. You know, the data is just moving more and more in that direction, but it's not going to be convincing to the deniers.
My favorite is when they look at recent data and they say that, oh, look, the overall trend is now changing because of this little tiny stretch of time in the recent history that seems to go against it. It's like, oh, like in evolution, of course, the parallels to evolution are there. And it's like today. I look at the temperature today. Today's October 2nd. It was 80 degrees. And that's like somebody saying, it's 80 degrees today, and you still think winter's coming? Give me a break. Yeah. Just because it was warm today. It's like, well, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's also just the baseline respect for science. I know that I don't understand the data. I know that I can't interpret it myself, or if I were to do it myself, there's time. I'm not willing to commit to do it. I respect the meteorologists around the globe, and I respect their education and that they're going to make a much better decision, analysis, conclusion, everything better than I would ever do it.
Yeah, it's complicated. You have to have a healthy respect for how complicated this science is. And unless you understand it at an expert level, it really is folly to try to substitute your own understanding for the consensus of scientific opinion. But that's what people do. And then they make statements that are just naive, that are just overly simplistic, and they don't really reflect the state of the science because they're not climate scientists.
What's the whole point? I don't understand it. I can understand 9/11 truthers because, you know, they have a distrust for the government.
All right, so I've spoken to many global warming skeptic, including people within the skeptical community. And what they focus on is that this is a, in their view, this is a liberal conspiracy to wrest power from, you know, the free enterprise, the marketplace, and to impose draconian government control over the energy marketplace by manufacturing a crisis that doesn't really exist.
So they think it's a liberal cover up.
They think that global warming is a liberal conspiracy to, you know, to, it's a manufactured crisis that they can use to enact a liberal agenda. That's what they think.
What about the non-liberal scientists? You know, why aren't one of those scientists saying, hey, this isn't what they're saying. They're trying to pull one over on everybody.
Well, you know, there are two or three.
There are some.
They're very much in the minority. You always seem to read the same names over and over again whenever they go to the climate scientist who denies global warming. It's always the same two or three people. And they're very much in the minority opinion, and they don't have a good case to make, in my opinion. I've read multiple scientific controversies, you know, like did a meteor wipe out the dinosaurs or was it something else? And you get reasoned, evidence-based arguments from both sides, even though I may find one side more compelling than the other. In this issue, you don't get that from the global warming deniers. You don't get, in my opinion, an evidence-based reasoned argument. You get very superficial, sometimes, you know, fallacious arguments, and as soon as you dig down, they evaporate. To me, that is how you decide, like, where the best arguments lay. Just you follow the exchange between the two sides, and those who are making the case that for anthropogenic global warming always seem to get, you know, the better of the argument. They have the evidence on their side. They have the, you know, the logic on their side. And then from the deniers, you get the dance. They make a point. They get to hit and run. They make one point. When that gets demolished, they move on to another point without ever really responding to the criticism of their initial point.
Steve, you mentioned that in your blog. I like that point in your blog where, you know, a consensus by definition isn't necessarily correct. I mean, there have been, you know, consensuses. There have been them in the past, and they weren't correct. So it doesn't mean just because it's a consensus. I mean, it means that you have a much greater likelihood of it being correct. But if you
it's all probability.
If you want to add a little bit more confidence to your belief in the consensus, then like you said, look at the exchange going back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, if one side's doing that dance and it's not a reasoned argument and they don't have any good points really, then chances are that consensus is even more likely to be correct.
All right, well, let's move on. We're going to take a break from the heavy-hitting items with a lighter item. Jay, this is actually a follow-up piece because we've talked about this topic before, but there's a quote-unquote scientist who claims that he's photographed the soul leaving the body.
Yeah, Russian physicist Konstantin Korokov. I believe there's a T in there, but I'm just going to say his last name is Korokov, believes that he has photographed someone's soul leaving their body at the moment of death using a bioelectrographic camera. And this is called astral disembodiment. It's when the soul leaves the body. So he takes his photography using a method called gas discharge visualization.
Jay, you usually use that method, gas discharge.
There's a
right?
gas.
Yeah, and when you can see it, you know it's deadly, particularly.
Right.
Run.
But this is really, this technique that he's using is just an advanced version of the Curlian photography.
Mm-hmm.
I will read a description of it. I thought Wikipedia did a very good job, so you guys can get an understanding of what it is, those of you who don't know. Curlian photography is a technique for creating contact print photographs using high voltage. The process entails placing sheet photographic film on top of metal discharge plate, and the object to be photographed is then placed directly on top of the film. High voltage is momentarily applied to the metal plate, thus creating an exposure. The corona discharge between the object and the high voltage plate is captured by the film. The developed film results in a Curlian photograph of the object. So, in essence, what's happening is this high discharge of electricity is interacting with whatever object the metal plate comes in contact with, and you're taking a picture of the coronal discharge, kind of like static electricity. And you're capturing that on film, and that's why you can really see some dramatic pictures using this technique. However, that doesn't mean that you're photographing a soul. As a matter of fact, you know, just by the definition of this type of photography, we can tell you with physics what you're actually taking a picture of. So it's interesting, and I think it's very pretty. I've seen wonderful pictures taken with this, you know, as an art form, and you know, maybe there's ways that people have used it to actually do some science, maybe getting an interesting or different look at things. But we're certainly not seeing a person's aura, which, you know, for those of you who don't know, the aura is believed to be the spiritual energy that forms a halo around an object or a person's body. And a lot of people believe that Curlian photography is taking a picture of people's auras. But the fact is, I just read a paragraph explaining the science, and we have this Russian physicist. The guy is a physicist. He understands what Curlian photography is. He understands what's happening on a molecular level.
Yeah, but Jay is also a total Fruit Loop.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. So after watching this guy's videos, I watched video of him talking, explaining his technology. I watched video of other people talking about his, you know, technology and what he's using, you know, the technique that he's using and all that. It is unbelievable the leap that this guy takes to get to the point where he's taking pictures of people on their deathbed and making claims about their soul leaving their body, and he's taking a photograph of it. And then he's going so far as saying things like, the first place that the soul leaves the body is the head and the navel. And the last place that the soul leaves the body is the groin and the chest area.
Of course
area,
it's the groin. Right?
Exactly. If you look at this as a skeptic or critical thinking exercise, it's interesting, right? So we have a trained scientist, I'm assuming because he's calling himself a physicist, that he went to a college, he has some training. You know, this is someone that is supposed to understand the scientific method, but yet he completely buys into this so much so that he, you know, has invented a pseudoscience, or, you know, augmented an existing, you know, pseudoscience.
Yeah, it's more like just augmented it, just running with it.
Right.
He's also, on his website, there's a video of him being interviewed by some crappy local news, and he's saying that with mind over matter, with your thoughts, you can control your environment. You can control the world around you. And mm-hmm. He has the audacity to say, and this, of course, is something totally new. Totally new. This is just the secret rehashed.
Yeah.
You know, this is hundreds of years old. This is not anything new at all. And then, of course, that's why people are resistant to it, because it's so new they can't handle it. No, they're resistant to it because it's stupid. That's why, because you're just making crap up. Not even putting an interesting spin on it, in terms of the mind over matter stuff.
At the very least, invoke quantum mechanics.
No, you watch the video and he drops the word quantum several times. Like he's peppering everything. Using the vocabulary of his education to make himself sound more intelligent.
You have to Chopra it up a bit, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There was one guy that totally buys in to this guy's, you know, claims and everything. And he's saying that he has a picture of himself with, I think it was his mother, and then his parents died. And then this picture, he's using this picture as proof. And it's a ghost picture. It's just, it looks like the typical, like, you know, there was smoke in the room. Someone photographed it. The light from the flash bounced off of it, has a particular eerie effect. And he is saying that the spirits of his parents are with him at all times. And I'm like, you know, I got you. I feel sorry for you. You know, we all have to go through losing family members, and it's a horrible experience and everything. But I mean, come on, you know, like how far are you going to make yourself feel better? It's just a, it's sad. It's this scientist is feeding into all these different people's anxieties and desires to believe that their family's still alive. Oh, and one more quick thing, Steve. Yeah. I read the comments to that article.
Why?
Whoa! Like, it is a classic debate from a skeptical perspective, you know, a snarky skeptical perspective and true believers. You know, if you want to just get critical thinking 101, dip into the comments on there and you'll see like the classic.
Yeah. They did a good job, didn't they, Jay? The skeptics did a decent job, yeah.
I would have appreciated a little bit less of the, you know, I'm smart, you're stupid, you know, I'm a skeptic and I'm smart business. Yeah. It's kind of hard not to do that because, you know, I totally get it. I know why people do that, especially online with internet balls, like always at the ready. I just think Steve's technique of kill them with kindness over the years, I've seen it proven over and over again. You don't give them anything to argue against you personally about. You know, they switch the topic very quickly to like, that's just a, you know, that guy's just mean or whatever. You don't want that. You want them to have to face your words.
Don't give them anything they can potentially come back to you about. Just stick to the science. Stick to the facts.
That's the hard part. You have to train yourself to get that, you know, almost sterile in a discussion. You don't want to get emotional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the next news item comes from Australia, from down under. A Melbourne pediatrician, Chris Pappas, was taking care of a four-month-old baby who had a fractured vertebra in the neck. Broken neck. Turns out that this four-month-old baby had just undergone chiropractic neck manipulation for torticollis. See. Dr. Pappas said it was lucky that the child recovered, you know, another millimeter, and it could have easily been quadriplegic, and who then reported the case to, you know, the Bureau of Health, who then turned it over to the chiropractic board. Surprise, surprise. You know, they investigated it. They didn't clear the chiropractor. They decided that he needed to go to further education
Of course. Yeah, there's no consequences.
Chiropractic management of babies, which legitimizes the practice.
Do you guys know what torticollis is? Like, you know, if you
dig in on
torticollis. Yeah, that's what I said. My son had it. And what it is it's not uncommon. Like a child could be used to sleeping on one side or sitting in a certain position. And, you know, they have so little muscle at that age, especially the neck muscles, that they could, you know, develop one side faster than the other. And then when that happens, it actually can exaggerate the problem. It could make it so they have they're more likely to look at, you know, to the right or to the left more than the other side or whatever. And, you know, the doctor was like, you know, you have to hold the baby a certain way. So they're forced to use the other side, the other neck muscles and everything. And luckily, you know, Dylan didn't have an extreme case of it. And, you know, we corrected it by doing some physical therapy or just lift his head stuff at home and everything. It wasn't that big of a deal, but it can be an ordeal for the child. Could take years to overcome it. But the bottom line is, you know, a chiropractor should not be treating this. This is something where they need, a certain type of physical therapy. And when I say physical therapy, I'm not talking about a quick office visit. Like, you need to do stuff with the baby at home. And in extreme cases, the baby will need to go see a therapist to get treatment. So the chiropractor should not have even begun to treat this situation.
Yeah. So, I mean, infantile torticollis is not uncommon. And there have been various studies, prospective studies, looking at hundreds of cases. And taking all comers, about 97% will get better with conservative management, meaning just some stretching exercises like you did with your son, Jay. That's it. It's almost always a self-limiting, benign, easily correctable with proven, safe and effective, you know, minimalist treatments, some stretching exercises, right, basically. The other 3% depend, there may be an underlying cause. You know, it's not something simple. Sometimes they have a tumor. You know, they might have a tumor in a muscle of their neck, for example, could be a cause.
Yep.
The chiropractors are essentially saying that they have an alternate treatment for something that already has a safe and effective treatment. Their treatment involves chiropractic neck manipulation, which, despite their claims that it's gentle and safe, we don't have evidence for that. They have not met their burden of proof to show that it's safe. They haven't shown that it's as effective as standard therapy. Or effective at all, let alone as effective as established therapy. I found only a couple of case reports, you know, in published on PubMed, and one It was a single case. It was a single case. It wasn't a case series. It wasn't prospective. It wasn't no comparison. It was a single case. And if you read the what they did, it was a 4 month old child with torticollis, and they treated the child with neck manipulation and stretching exercises and pillow correction. They basically gave the child standard therapy plus neck manipulation, and the child got better, which almost everyone does on standard therapy alone. So that one case report shows nothing, absolutely nothing. Certainly does
Steve,
not establish
what specifically happened to the baby's neck. Did he actually break a bone in his neck?
He had what's called a hangman's fracture, called that for obvious reasons. It can be produced by hyperextension of the neck. So that's probably was the mechanism of the fracture.
As a recent parent, and I'm swimming in like the – you know, the love and incredible overprotective feelings for my child right now. When I read this article, I had like a 15-minute meltdown. Think about it. Could you just imagine, you know, that happening to your child? There was nothing wrong with that child. It was most likely, like Steve said, a very quick and easy, you know, fix. Did nothing to it. And that guy made that child have to have surgery to correct this problem.
Yeah, but he's regulated by other chiropractors who won't even admit that there's no legitimate indication for manipulation on babies. This was the issue that Simon Singh got sued at by the British Chiropractic Association. And the BCA came out with their list of evidence to support, you know, childhood indications for manipulation. I reviewed all of their references, and they actually, in not a single case, did it support effectiveness of chiropractic. And they also left off the most damning negative links. So they literally cherry picked the evidence, and even their cherry picked evidence did not support their claims, let alone a thorough review of the evidence. There isn't a single established indication for chiropractic manipulation in children or babies. So if you do a risk versus benefit analysis, the benefit is none. There's no established benefit for anything. And the risk is, we don't know what the risk is because they don't really keep track of it very well, but we know that there are case reports of harm of, and you know, so the Australian Chiropractic Association says there hasn't been a case of a baby being harmed by a chiropractor since 1992 without further explanation. That's because in 1992, there was a case report of a child who became quadriplegic because the chiropractor manipulated his neck. And there was a tumor that could have easily had been treated, but because it was manipulated, it bled, and that caused, you know, destroyed the spinal cord and caused the baby to become quadriplegic.
So what happened to that guy?
I don't know. But that's blatant malpractice. The Australian Chiropractic Association is denying that the chiropractor broke the baby's neck. They're doing their typical defense when it came in. Or? Yeah, so that's one thing. Oh, maybe it was already broken. Maybe the parents did it. So they're trying to blame the parents for it. And then, but they pull the same thing with chiropractic stroke. You know, because when people have like a dissection, a tear in the vertebral arteries after a chiropractic manipulation, they'll say, how do you know that the tear wasn't there to begin with? Well, first of all, we have evidence that the tear occurs after the chiropractic manipulation, sometimes immediately after. But it's also not that much of a defense, because if there were a fracture or there were a tear, then you shouldn't manipulate that neck. They were negligent in manipulating the baby if he had a fracture to begin with. So they're just substituting one type of negligence for another. That's not really a defense. The underlying problem is that chiropractic as a profession is not science-based. And therefore, there's no science-based standard of care. And if you have no standard of care, then regulation is irrelevant. And that's what we're seeing in this case. What are you regulating? You know, if there's no, you know, evidence base to establish what you're doing.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we're almost dancing around the obvious, which is there should not be chiropractic. Laws should be changed and make it illegal to perform this.
Well, yeah, in a perfect world, but it's too well entrenched. Yeah, we have this debate amongst ourselves, you know, the science-based medicine proponents, should our position be the elimination of chiropractic as a pseudoscientific and poorly regulated profession, or should we be advocating for, you know, short of that, a massive overhaul of the profession to bring it into, you know, the 21st century, into the science-based medicine age?
Yeah, but what do chiropractors offer that other sorts of doctors can't offer, nothing. Right? I don't think there's anything.
Anything that's unique to chiropractic is pseudoscience. When chiropractors practice within the limits of evidence-based medicine, they're basically glorified physical therapists. And maybe not even as good as actually well-trained physical therapists. So I don't think that they bring anything unique or new to the table.
Goodbye. That's it. Just get rid of them. They're a joke.
The only thing that's really been established to be effective is manipulation for lower back pain. And that is no better than physical therapy
or just medical care. Right.
And it's only slightly better than handing a pamphlet to a patient that tells them how to take care of their back. Slightly better than a pamphlet.
Uh-huh.
All right, Bob. You're going to tell us a couple of news items about black holes.
All right, guys. So a decades-old astronomical mystery has been solved recently. There's this huge – I wasn't even aware of a lot of this. This is pretty interesting. There's a huge glowing filament of gas near our galactic core called the Magellanic Stream.
It's like Magellan taking a piss, right?
Nice. Now the Magellanic Stream glows with an intensity that cannot be explained. And for years, they're like, well, why is this thing so bright? And it seems now that it glows because of a supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy. What's the name of the black hole? You guys know?
Disney made a movie about it.
No, they didn't. Not about this one. Sagittarius A. Our black hole, Sagittarius A, apparently entered a very brief period of intense activity not long ago. And actually, it was incredibly intense. Imagine it was about 100 million times more, more power than is emanating today. So it's pretty intense. And this is what lit up that gas. This is what they think. And the other side of the coin, though, the other interesting part of this is that it shows that supermassive black holes can flicker, going from maximum activity to a more of a quiescent state relatively quickly. So this was a really interesting little astronomical detective story. It started about 2.5 billion years ago. The two dwarf galaxies in orbit in the local group with us, the large and small Magellanic Clouds, they had a close encounter that started a period of really intense star formation. And so while this was happening, huge chunks of their gas kind of collided and they ran into each other. And this caused not only the star formation, but it caused a lot of this gas to be ejected from the galaxies. And eventually they arced over the core of our galaxy. And this stream, this is the Magellanic Stream. And this was discovered in the 70s. And now in the 90s, astronomers determined that this stream is glowing much more brightly than it should. And that's got to mean that it was hit at some point in the past with a really intense form of light, probably ultraviolet. Now, our galaxy has a lot of stars that emits a lot of ultraviolet light, but only a few percent of it actually escapes our galaxy. Most of it is just reabsorbed. So that really can't account for it. Plus, we've never had enough stars to account for that kind of glow. So that's the mystery in the nutshell. Then in 2003, a hurricane of particles were discovered leaving the core of our galaxy. And it's kind of like our sun's solar wind, but it's much, much more powerful. And then the final clue that came in 2010, the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope discovered these two giant lobes of gamma rays bulging out of the north and south poles of the Milky Way core. I talked about this, I think, a couple years ago, 2010, I think. It's pretty huge, 50,000 light years across. I mean, this is just these immense bubbles of gamma rays. So the key then to solving this mystery was linking these three different things together, the Magellanic Stream, the gamma ray bubbles, and the galactic's solar wind. When they looked at them and they tried to line them up, everything seemed to fall into place, making it seem like they were all related. So this is what they think happened. 2 million years ago, a star or a huge cloud of gas got sucked into Sagittarius A, our black hole, creating...
Sorry, Bob, 2 million years ago?
2 million years ago.
Okay.
Got sucked in and created a spinning accretion disk. That's what happens. And so this created blasts of ultraviolet radiation and X-rays, and that made the Magellanic Stream glow. And it also created that powerful wind of particles like the solar wind, which also generated the huge gamma ray bubble. So there you go. So like I mentioned earlier, this is really cool because it also shows that black holes can go from a hibernation state to becoming really, really incredibly active and then back again, kind of that they call it flickering. So what about the future? Will we ever see anything like that? Of course, it's possible, but actually, and this shocked the crap out of me, they're actually tracking a cloud near Sagittarius A called G2. Very unimaginative, but this cloud, G2, may fall into the black hole next year. You know, not within a thousand years or a million years, but they're saying next year, like within 300 days.
I want a quickie with Bob.
Thank you, Evan, for requesting a quickie. Are you ready for something big? This is your quickie with Bob. And I call this item Hirsute Black Holes. Black holes may not have any hair. Did you guys know that? In 1963, physicist Roy Kerr proposed a clean black hole model, or in other words, the no-hair theory. And that basically means that all black holes can be completely described by only two quantities, the mass and angular momentum, which is rotational velocity. That's it. That's all you need, and that's all you could really know about it. Everything else would stem from those two quantities. So any other aspect of the star that collapsed to form the black hole would be forever lost, since all black holes would be essentially identical, except, of course, from their mass and the angular momentum. So now, however, Thomas Sotiriou, he's a physicist of the International School of Advanced Studies of Trieste, he's co-authored a paper, perhaps we should call it the Propecia paper, that puts hair back on black holes. It's true that the no-hair model is consistent with general relativity, which is good and important, but it may not be consistent with some of the popular extensions to Einstein's theory, such as tensor-scalar theories. What's this hair then? What the hell is it? It's obviously not hair. Some describe it as a new charge, which somehow anchors the surrounding matter to the black hole. It's also been described as something, some type of previously unknown type of gravitational waves. So future research may not only definitively make black holes hairy, but it could also help us more fully understand the origins of gravity itself. That's all I got. This has been your Quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
That's good work, Bob.
Well done.
All right, Evan, I'm very interested to find out what that noisy was from last week.
Yeah, let's play it again to remind everyone exactly what it is we played last week. So here we go. As a woman once said on YouTube when looking at a rainbow, what the hell is that? Okay, well, what you have here is something called the Leidenfrost effect. Have you guys ever heard of that before? Have you?
No. Yeah, absolutely. It's a nice cushion of air that prevents heat transfer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you drop some water on a hot skillet, the bead of water bounces around. It takes a long time to actually vaporize. Because of the Leidenfrost effect.
Give Bob a cigar. He is exactly correct. Yes.
That's good work, Bob.
And that's what we're hearing here. But specifically what's happening in the video from which I pulled this audio clip is that the fella has taken a ball of nickel and heated it up to a very, very high temperature. He's gone ahead then and dropped it into a cup of cold water. Or room temperature water, it doesn't really matter. And that's that noise that you hear. There's sort of this initial noise, and then you kind of have that building up of that sort of surrounding...
vapor?
Yeah, right, the vapor. And then once it releases, that's when the bigger noises occur a few seconds later. So it's very cool.
Interesting.
There were a lot of people who got this correct. There was a high school physics teacher from California who knew exactly what this was, and I thought he wrote up the best description of this, so I'd like to read that for you. His name's John Davis, and here's what John says. So these are the sweet sounds of the Leidenfrost effect. The effect is usually produced by plunging red-hot metal, often in the shape of a sphere, into water. When the hot metal comes into contact with the water, some water immediately vaporizes and forms a bubble of steam around the metal sphere. Since water vapor is a poor conductor of heat compared to liquid water, the vapor prevents the metal sphere from immediately cooling. As some of the vapor on the edge of the bubble cools and once again condenses to liquid, the bubble breaks, and liquid water again makes contact with the sphere. The characteristic and repeating pinging sound you hear, is made when the vaporizing water vibrates between the metal and the liquid water. So thank you, John, for putting that into very, very good layman's terms for us all. And the winner this week from the message boards, her name is Neverbug.
cover bug.
She guessed correctly. Her name was drawn. She is this week's
winner. Is that a request not to be bugged or a promise that she will never bug somebody else?
It could be both.
No kill eye.
No kill eye, yeah.
No kill eye.
All right, Ev, what do you got for this week?
This week, another noisy for you. I'm going to play. And let's do it. Here we go.
To have this blame, this horrendous event, when, in fact, the official story is a lie, is just totally, I don't have words for it. It's like a crime against humanity is what it is. Not like, it is.
This person is somewhat known, I think, in skeptical circles, as a purveyor of some very dubious sorts of claims. So that's a little hint for everyone. And give it a guess. Send it to us in email if you like, WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or go to our forums, like Neverbug did, and post your answer there. That's SGUforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. I'm going to try to get to a couple of emails this week. The first one comes from John from Kansas City, and John writes, I've never contacted you before, but I just listened to this past weekend's podcast and I wanted to contribute a bit to the Monsanto discussion. I just wanted to point out the two main non-science related reasons people dislike Monsanto. First, they have actively fought pretty heavily any sort of labeling or consumer awareness initiatives. For example, there was recently a bill in California that would require the labeling of any foods with GM ingredients to make consumers aware of what they are eating. This bill was defeated primarily due to Monsanto's campaigning against it. This just feeds the idea that they have something to hide about their products. Second, Monsanto has a history of aggressively suing farmers whose crops get cross-pollinated with their seeds. As a member of a family of farmers, this one is pretty disgusting. Since bees pollinate without regard to whose field is whose, if a farmer next to you uses Monsanto-grown GM seed, you run a high risk of some of the GM crops to show up in your field. Monsanto monitors this and does not hesitate to sue the other farmers for use of their patented seed stock. They have been ordered by the courts to stop this practice, but it certainly doesn't help that the perception that they have any societal good in mind. In my opinion, Monsanto's business practices are significantly more heinous than many other consumer goods manufacturers, which I loosely define them as. This is obviously a personal opinion, but I just wanted to contribute. Thanks for all your work. So what do you guys think about that?
I think he's right about how are they supposed to control, right, this pollination for lack of a better term, naturally occurs in a farming industry. Yeah. And what, you're going to go ahead and sue the people because some of your product drifted over through the winds?
Yeah, it sounds outrageous, right?
Crazy.
It also happens not to be true.
That's the other part. Yeah, is it true?
So it's propaganda. So I've read a lot of this before, but over the last week, because we were getting a lot of feedback about Monsanto, I really did a deep dive on this particular issue. So last week we talked about a news item that was discussing scientific reviews of studies looking at the health effects of GMO food. And the conclusions are pretty solid that there is no health risk to humans from consuming GMO food. But there are two other issues that come up with respect to GMO. One is the business practices and economics of GMO, and the other is the environmental impact. The health effects, I think, are the easiest issue to deal with. There's no evidence of harm, and there's pretty good evidence. The studies that have been put forward showing that there is risk are all crap. You know, we've reviewed some of them on the show. The environmental issues are actually the most complicated. I'm actually not going to delve into that this week. I'm going to focus on the other thing, the practices of Monsanto. Now, last week I made the basic claim that, you know, yes, corporations need to be good citizens. We need transparency and regulation. And I certainly believe that corporations mainly act in their own financial best interest. But I've never seen any evidence that Monsanto was any worse than the average corporation in this respect. They've just become this icon of evil. You know, they've become the boogeyman of the anti-GMO ideology. I wanted to find out what the specific cases were. Again, not to try to look past opinion and ideology and say, okay, well, what are the cases? When people criticize Monsanto for their business practices, give me the worst business practices that they've done, and I'll take a look at what actually happened. So I'm going to discuss four cases that are the ones that keep, that I keep encountering when I read about Monsanto's business practices. If a listener feels that there's another case that better represents malfeasance on the part of Monsanto, I'm all ears. Again, I have no dog in this hunt, as they say, whatever. I'm perfectly willing to believe that Monsanto's done some squirrely, even really bad things in their behalf. But I'm just let me know what they are. Let me see the actual case. So what John is referring to is a Canadian case, Percy Schmeiser. He's a farmer that was sued by Monsanto for planting canola that was belonged, you know, canola seeds that were genetically modified by Monsanto. And Monsanto said this was a violation of their patent. And this now has become the iconic case of Monsanto sues farmers who have seed blow into their farms. I've never seen any evidence that that's the case. This is what actually happened. Schmeiser noticed that some of the canola plants growing along the side of the road by his farm were not dying when the roadside was sprayed with herbicide. He figured, oh, this must be some of that GM, you know, herbicide resistant canola from other farms blowing in, because he wasn't using the seeds himself. So he checked his own canola farm, and the one section that he investigated, he basically sprayed it with the Roundup, and 60% of the plants in his farm were GMO, were the Monsanto Roundup Ready canola plants. He was not sued for that. He was not sued for that. What he was sued for was this. The next year, he took only the GM seeds from the plants that blew into his property, and he planted his entire canola fields with GM seeds. When those farms were investigated, they were found to be 98% GMO, which does not happen by accident. So he was sued for using those seeds deliberately to bypass Monsanto's patent. That's what he was sued for. The Canadian Supreme Court agreed with Monsanto and ruled in their favor. Another similar case, Bowman versus Monsanto, a farmer purchased GMO seed grain that was sold as feed. Now, feed and planting seeds are the same thing, right? But you can't, you know, when you buy seed from Monsanto that's genetically modified, you're buying it for a single planting, and that's your contract. You're contracted for a single planting. You can't harvest the seeds and replant them, because if you were allowed to do that, then Monsanto's patent becomes worthless, right? If you say that once you, any seeds that derive from the GM plants, if you're allowed to do whatever you want with them, then literally Monsanto seed patents are worthless at that point.
Right. I can't buy something on iTunes and then go and then resell using it for my own purposes, selling it, sharing it, or whatever.
You can use it. You can use it for your license to use it in a very limited way.
That's right. That's right.
So it's the same thing with the seed. You're licensed for one planting, and that's it. And Monsanto has been very aggressive, absolutely, in protecting their patent and not allowing any argument that ever says that any of their own seeds, the seeds that they developed and they patented, are outside the reach of their patent. Because once a single seed is outside the reach of their patent, it's over. That, you know, variety, the market will evaporate, because then the seeds can reproduce themselves, right? So Bowman, he wanted to do another planting, and he wanted the GM seeds because they were cost effective. So he bought the feed seed and then planted that. In violation of Monsanto's patent. He deliberately was circumventing the patent.
Yep, misused.
Yep, so Monsanto sued him for doing that. This case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and this is just this year. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of Monsanto 9-0, which means even the most liberal judges agreed that Monsanto's patent covered those seeds.
You don't get 9-0 decisions often.
Yeah, you don't get 9-0. And the Obama administration filed an amicus brief in favor of Monsanto's position, because they realized that. So the argument that Bowman was making was that what's called patent exhaustion, which means that, like, once you buy something, then you have the right to do with it what you will. And the company is no longer covered by the patent, right? Mm-hmm. They're no longer protected by their patent. But the Supreme Court agreed that with Monsanto that if that were the case for GM seeds, then the patents would be worthless. And therefore, you know, the biotech industry in general is not viable if they can't, if the fruits of their research are not protected by patents. So they rejected the exhaustion, the patent exhaustion argument, and ruled in favor of Monsanto. And again, it was not really a legally controversial decision. Universities, industry, anyone, any industry that has to invest a lot of money and then protect their intellectual property with patents was absolutely on the side of Monsanto because the patent exhaustion argument would have destroyed the utility of a lot of patents, not just in the biotech industry.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't he genetically modify plants so that don't produce any seeds? That would be nice.
Well, the seeds are the food, right? It's like, you know, but all right. So this is not one of my cases that I found, but I did. Monsanto was criticized for developing Terminator seeds. You guys ever hear that term? These are seeds that are sterile. So
there you go.
They're very powerful.
How's that work?
So in other words, like you have GM corn, and the corn kernels are usable as food, but they will not. You can't grow plants from them. They're sterile.
So
therefore, it completely eliminates the possibility of getting a second planting out of the seeds that you buy from Monsanto. Now, Monsanto claims that it did this in order to avoid its genetically modified genes getting into the environment. This was supposed to protect the environment. But they were criticized of doing this in order to maintain their monopoly over the seeds. And they actually ended the program and have said that they have no intention of ever marketing Terminator seeds. But that's something else that you might hear as another more evidence that they're evil, something they never actually marketed. One other case I found was 73 organic and conventional farmer seed companies advocacy groups sued Monsanto preemptively in March of 2011, arguing that they needed to protect themselves from Monsanto suing them for seed blowing onto their farms. Again, they're misinterpreting the Schmeiser case. This case was thrown out as frivolous, and that judgment was upheld on appeal. Monsanto, you know, said they have absolutely no intention of ever suing anybody who does not want to steal their seeds. They're only suing people who are deliberately using their seeds and violating their patent.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it's ridiculous. You know, they're never going to sue anybody because seed blows onto their farm. And if the organic farmers are saying, we don't want your GM seeds on our farm, good, then Monsanto has absolutely no incentive to sue you. And they never have. So that was a completely fabricated case invented just to get a PR, you know, hit against Monsanto. And if you read the lawyer, the spokesman for the farmers who sued Monsanto, they say that they do not think that seeds should be patentable. So they have a clear
agenda,
one-sided ideological position.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a separate question. And I'm fine with people who say they don't think that living organisms should be allowed to be patented. If that's your position, that's fine. Then make that the debate, not trumped up cases about a company defending their patents. The last case was, this is a very interesting. So Greenpeace accused Monsanto of biopiracy for patenting an existing wheat cultivar. So, this is another one that this is the way the story is presented by the anti-GMO contingent is that Monsanto patented a particular kind of wheat called Nap Hal, which is grown in India. It has a lower amount of gluten and it's therefore very usable for making flat breads that are used in parts of India.
Non-bread.
So they said, Monsanto basically, you know, stole this wheat from the Indian farmers who cultivated it themselves over years. And they were doing this in order to monopolize their wheat industry. And it was just pure biopiracy. Here's the real story. The real story is that another company by the name of Unilever, they bought some of the Nap Hal seeds. And then they developed from them, they cultivated from them a new variety called Galatea. And then they filed for a patent for this new variety called Galatea. Monsanto purchased the company Unilever and in so doing acquired the patent application for the Galatea. And several years later, that patent was granted. So they had a patent on this cultivar of wheat. Monsanto did not file the patent. They didn't create this variety. They just acquired it as part of a purchase of another company. Of course, the anti-GMO people went crazy because now Monsanto's involved. They're like, oh, Monsanto's trying to abuse and exploit, you know, these Indian wheat farmers. Monsanto, first of all, said, we have no intention of exploiting this patent. And they never did. They never did anything with this patent. In fact, they were getting out of the wheat, you know, game in Europe in at any case. So they really weren't interested in going in this direction. But Greenpeace used this to accuse them of biopiracy. Now, the one element of legitimate criticism here, and this really applies to Unilever, you know, that because Monsanto didn't do this, the company they bought did it, is that the Galatea variety really didn't have anything new or beneficial that wasn't already present in the Napal, the older wheat variety that was developed through normal cultivation processes by Indian farmers over generations. So they basically took an existing variety of wheat, tweaked it, and patented it, but they didn't really do anything, make anything new or unique. And then eventually they actually, you know, Greenpeace did sue on those grounds, and the patent was revoked. But, you know, Monsanto never did anything with the patent anyway. It was all literally, it was just all hysteria. It was just all trumped up to try, because to attack, Monsanto, in my opinion. So those are the cases that keep coming up. If there's other cases out there you want me to know about, tell me. I'll look into them. Again, I'm not saying categorically that Monsanto has never done anything squirrely. It all comes down to this. When you read like Greenpeace and all the people who criticize them, they all come back to, no company should have a patent on any life form, including any seed. Okay, fine. Then how are you going to have a biotech industry? Of course, they don't want a biotech industry because they're against GMO in the first place. So the fact that there's nobody developing genetically modified products doesn't bother them at all.
It's really easy to interpret everything that you just said in a very negative, anti-corporate way, right? Like those, you can easily make an argument where you're like, yeah, but that's BS. They knew that they were going to buy that company and they knew that they were going to get their hands on that patent.
You can make everything seem sinister, but the facts are the facts. You know, without having to interpret anything one way or the other, the fact is, yes, Monsanto defends their patents. Absolutely. Because they understand that if seeds get outside the reach of their patent, that their market can be destroyed. They've never sued anybody because seeds blown onto their farm. They never exploited that wheat patent that they acquired from Unilever. They said they weren't going to, and they didn't. Those are the facts. Those are the indisputable facts. Now, how you interpret their motives, things that you can't really know, that's ideology. That's going to be your own personal bias. And again, I have no bias one way or the other. What I don't like are these cases being presented in a distorted fashion that is not factually accurate in order to portray Monsanto, to demonize them, as I said last week, to demonize this company, to make them the evil icon of genetically modified food and the biotech industry. That is propaganda. That's not the facts. If we're going to have an argument about what the limits of patenting seeds should be, let's have a risk versus benefit. You know, what are the pluses and minuses? Do we want a biotech industry? They have to benefit from their research and their investment. This is exactly like the pharmaceutical industry, right? Pharmaceutical industry, they invest hundreds of millions of dollars developing pharmaceuticals. Yes, these are critical to the health and well-being of the populace, but they're allowed to make money off of their patents. You know, they're granted a limited exclusivity. They defend their patents jealously. Monsanto's no different than the pharmaceutical industry in this regard. And the pharmaceutical companies do squirrely things all the time and outright illegal things sometimes. They get fined and judgments against them for doing things that they shouldn't do all the time. In fact, I think from what I've seen, I don't think Monsanto is any worse than your average pharmaceutical company. But it's all just big agro conspiracy mongering.
Yeah.
And it is part of an anti-GMO ideological agenda. But you ask anybody in the public and they go, oh yeah, Monsanto sues farmers for seeds blowing onto their farm.
Yeah. Everyone knows that, right? It's become the narrative.
It's the narrative.
Yeah, that gets out. It's too bad. It's reality.
It's irrelevant to the whole GMO thing, in my opinion, at least to, you know, to the health and environmental issues. It's all a matter of how are we going to regulate the biotech industry? How are we going to protect the incentive of doing research without hurting farmers? I understand that now farmers have to buy seeds and they can't just replant their own seeds, but this is a bargain that we have to make. You know, maybe we could explore other ways, you know, Monsanto could license seeds for a certain limited number of replantings. I don't know. There may be other options that can be explored here. And I do think that, the industry has to, I don't think that Monsanto's self-interest, their profits and their patents are the only thing that need to be defended here, the only issue here. Absolutely. We also need to consider the economics of farms, of, you know, of the family farm in addition to large industrial farms and have the whole system work. I get that. That's perfectly reasonable. Yeah. But let's do it within the law with the facts. Let's have a real fact-based discussion. And not base it on distorted propaganda. Again, if there's a case to be made against the way the industry is currently being regulated, distorting the information just discredits your side.
Yep.
When you find out what the real information is, you realize, okay, yep, they're just lying. Then, mm-hmm, you know, it actually hurts that side of the equation, in my opinion. And again, this is what I found researching this as heavily as I could for the last week. If somebody thinks there's a case out there that is a better representation of the situation, send it to me. We'll talk about it. I'll investigate it as much as I can myself. All right. One more quick email. This one comes from Matt Turner from Sheffield, England. And Matt writes, "Hi, SGU. I've read an article where data from a previous study has been reanalyzed. The article says that the previous study was overpowered and that this increases the risk of type 1 errors, i.e. the detection of statistically significant difference in the sample where there is no true difference in the population. Can you explain what this means? I thought that more data points would have always yielded better results. Keep up the good work." That is an excellent question, Matt. Hmm. This is something that comes up all the time, especially in science-based medicine where we're doing our analysis. Do you guys understand what he's talking about here?
Absolutely.
No.
So this is the difference between statistical significance and there being a real effect. And often, like when we talk about psi research, for example, you know, ESP, things like that, we frequently, you know, the proponents will say, "Oh, look, we have this study with thousands of data points and we have a statistically significant result." And that's a classic example of the overpowered study. There's two types of significance, you know, with studies like that. Statistical significance is just looking at the data itself. And the more power you have in a study, the smaller an effect size that you'll be able to detect with statistical significance. Right? Does that make sense? A smaller study would only be able to get to significance if you have a large effect. A really big study with thousands of data points, you can have statistical significance for a tiny effect. The reason why that introduces new types of problems is because if there is any systematic error or bias in the protocol, the more powerful the study, the smaller the effect that can reach statistical significance. And so you could have these tiny biases in a study resulting in statistically significant results, but the effect is not real. It's just a flaw in the design or execution of the study. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So the bigger the study, the tighter the controls have to be.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The bigger the study, the more rigorous and the absolutely ironclad the whole protocol has to be in order to avoid quirky results, which will seem impressive because they might have like really big statistically significant, you know, levels. But it's not a real phenomenon. It's just a fluke of the or a bad design of the study or some kind of systematic error or bias in the study itself.
And the terminology is called overpowering or overpowering?
Yeah, the study's overpowered, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, which increases the risk of type 1 error. Type 1 error is a false positive, basically saying that there's an effect there when there really isn't.
I like overpowered. It's like a car or even a computer that has an engine that's just too powerful for the chassis, you know, just can't handle it. And you could have crazy, crazy stuff happening because it really wasn't designed to handle something that powerful. So I like that analogy.
Which is why, like, if you're trying to establish that a new phenomenon is real, you know, something new about how the universe works, we not only want to see statistically significant results, we also want to see that there is a reasonable effect size. And we become suspicious of any really tiny effect size, no matter how statistically significant it is, because it's hard to weed out the tiniest effect from a study. There's subtle sources of bias that researchers could miss. A big effect size, it's hard. It's harder to create that, you know? It's harder for that to be an artifact. But tiny effect sizes are never really compelling, no matter how significant they are, because unless it's like, you know, looking at electrons or something, you know, there's a protocol that you can control, you know, down to multiple decimal places. Certainly nothing where you're dealing with people can be that tight. All right, guys, let's move on.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you all could play along from home. Are you all ready for this week?
Roger that.
Si, senor.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. The most robust study to date finds that depression does not increase risk for developing cancer. Item number two. A new study finds that bystander CPR for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest more than doubles short- and long-term survival. And item number three, scientists have discovered the gene variants that in most people determine left or right handedness. Jay, go first.
Okay, the first one about depression not increasing risk for developing cancer. Interesting. I see no reason to think why depression would increase the risk of developing cancer. I just can't think of any reason why that is. I would even suspect that not being true, so I'm just going to say that one's true. The second one about the bystander CPR and that it increases, it doubles the short and long-term survival. That's another one. I could totally see that, that being true, but I could question whether or not it's performed correctly. And maybe sometimes, if this one's the fake, that they do more damage than good because of how, most people are not practiced at it. And then finally, the third one about the, gene variants. That they found that will determine whether or not people are going to be left-handed or right-handed. That's interesting. And I can't see any reason to think that that's not true. So I'm going to say that the second one about CPR is the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Oh, that's a good one this week. Depression not increasing risk for cancer. The stress you go through with depression, I think, is so dramatic and huge. But what's the link between stress cancer risk? Not sure. Bystander CPR. I've always heard from you as well, Steve, that that CPR isn't that helpful in many cases outside of the hospital. But I'm trying to think of what you were specifically talking about. Was it just cardiac arrest? And I also agree with Jay that how good are people really at doing CPR? What they show on TV is a joke. I mean, that's completely unrealistic.
I mean, like the 30-second CPR they do before they give up? Yeah.
And then I've got a problem with the third one, too. I mean, for some reason, I have a memory of handedness not really being genetic. Wasn't it some sort of epigenetic trait? Shit. I don't know. Wow. I'm going to go with the handedness, the genes. It's fiction.
Okay. Ah. Evan?
I was thinking about that one, too, Bob. The first one about depression does not increase risk for developing cancer. I'm having a hard time remembering where depression and cancer. Have we spoken about this on the show? We may have touched on this on a news item in which they did have some sort of correlation of a person's mental state of mind and how that can possibly be a factor. So the second one about CPR, I'm leaning towards this one being the fiction because the bystander CPR, well, we know now that you don't do the breathing part of it. That's a bad practice. It just takes away time from you massaging the heart, getting those chest beats in. That's really what you're supposed to be doing is how they teach CPR now. But here's the thing. Will it double short and long-term survival? So you really have two kind of different scenarios here, and it's effective in both cases. I'm thinking maybe it's effective in one, but perhaps not the other. That's why I'm leaning towards that one being fiction. The last one about genetic variants. Yeah, Bob, you mentioned epigenetics. I kind of thought the same thing. It's not an environmental factor. I would be surprised if that were really a genetic. You could trace that down to the gene. But I think I'll go with my heart. The CPR one's not making the most sense to me here, so I'll say the CPR one's the fiction.
Okay. So you all agree in the first one, the most robust study to date finds that depression does not increase risk for developing cancer. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, previous studies did show a possible link between being depressed and later risk of developing cancer for stress or whatever. But the most robust of such studies done to date showed no connection. Being depressed does not make you more likely to have cancer at any point. Mm-hmm. The researchers reviewed data from 14,203 people who were followed in a cohort since 1989. So essentially that there was no correlation there. People do become depressed when they get cancer. So there, you know, if you just look at it that way, there obviously is a link, but there's no evidence that the depression increases the risk of later developing cancer. This is interesting because there is a very common meme, especially in the alternative medicine world, that you can make yourself better with a good attitude. You know, that thinking happy thoughts, guided imagery, all that stuff improves outcome. It really doesn't. And the evidence does not support that it helps. But also, I've always been bothered by it because it's kind of blaming the victim. It's like, well, if you got cancer, it's your fault because you have a negative attitude. Mm. Or yeah. if you don't do well, it's like blaming somebody who doesn't respond to a faith healing because their faith wasn't strong
enough.
Enough
faith.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, the one thing, Steve, about trying to maintain a positive attitude is like it may help your sleep.
Yeah.
You know, which could have an effect on your health. But beyond that, I don't think that what you're thinking and what's going on in your mind is affecting, you know, the cells in your body like a one-to-one relationship.
Yeah, but that's the common claim that there is. And again, yeah, sure.
But it's crap.
Nothing wrong with a positive attitude, and you know, being hopeful versus being anxious is generally a positive, you know, effect on doing better overall. Sure. But cancer is cancer. Doesn't really seem to have any effect. Maybe on pain perception, on cardiac survival.
You know, you're delaying now.
Am I? Okay. So you want me to move on? Number two, a new study finds that bystander CPR for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest more than doubles short and long-term survival. Jay and Evan, you both think this one is the fiction.
I can't watch.
Gullibly thinks this one is science. This one is science.
Oh, good job, Bob.
It hurts. The pain. The pain is palpable.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting, and evidence on the effectiveness of CPR has been somewhat mixed. A lot of it does depend upon the quality of the education, the quality of the CPR that's done. Typically, non-medical bystander out-of-hospital CPR outcomes are terrible, and the CPR that people get is of poor quality. That's part of the reason for the adoption of the automatic defibrillators, and people definitely do better if those automatic defibrillators are available in airports, et cetera.
All over.
But you have to be, there has to be somebody trained to use them properly in order to get the benefit. This was a study in Denmark, and they had a 10-year follow-up. So this was before and after instituting a program to try to train more people on how to do CPR. And they found that the presence of somebody, a bystander who can do CPR, it does have a significant effect on survival. And in every time frame that they looked at it, it more than doubled it. So throughout this study period, there was an increase in the proportion of patients receiving bystander CPR from 21.1 to 44.9%, whereas using an automatic defibrillator increased from 1.1 to 2.2%, still a very small percentage of people getting the automatic defibrillator. What they also found was that patients alive on arrival at the hospital increased from 7.9 to 21.8%, 30-day survival from 3.5 to 10.8, and one-year survival 2.8 to 10.2%.
Wow, that's very significant.
So still, one-year survival after cardiac arrest in the field, still only 10%, but it's three times.
Better than 2%.
Better than 3%. Yeah, it's three times if you didn't get CPR. So very interesting. Definitely means that CPR education programs are worthwhile. Good public health measure. Of course, all of this means that scientists have discovered the gene variants that in most people determine left or right-handedness is the fiction. And Bob, you are correct. It's fiction because it's not very genetically determined. It's probably the environment of the womb or other quirky aspects of development, but there is no gene for left-handedness. In fact, there was a recent study that inspired this item. Researchers essentially demonstrated that there is no significant genetic component to handedness. They ruled out any major contributor. There could be some weak genetic influences, but they ruled out any strong genetic determinant influencing handedness.
How can they do that?
Interesting. They did. It was a twin study. So they looked at twins and different handedness among twins.
No wonder Bob got this right. What the hell? Total advantage, Bob.
Good work, Bob.
Dizygotic twin.
Who cares? A twin's a twin, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, you guys have your psychic power. Yeah, good job, Bob. Well done.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Jay, you got a quote for us this week?
I have a quote. This quote was sent in from a listener named Ben A., from Manchester, United Kingdom. And this is a quote from the inventor of judo, Jigoro Kano. Kano. That's where they got the name Kano from. Interesting. I didn't know that guy's name. And Jigoro said, "In an argument, you may silence your opponent by pressing an advantage of strength or of wealth or of education, but you do not really convince him. Though he is no longer saying anything, in his heart he still keeps to his opinion. The only way to make him change that opinion is to speak quietly and reasonably. When he understands that you are not trying to defeat him but only to find the truth, he will listen to you and perhaps accept what you tell him." Jigoro Kano!
Yeah.
The art of quiet persuasion, huh?
That's the way to do it. Just gotta, you know, we've said this a million times. Take your time. You know, don't try to win an argument. Don't beat someone over the head. Don't try to, you know, take away the thing that's the most important to them. You know, what I do is I just let a lot of time go by. I'll subtly talk to people and feed them more information and try to kind of help them get there on their own. It seems to be the best way.
Yep. Oh, a Monsanto seed.
It's the way we've chosen.
Don't do that.
Well, thank you guys for joining me this week. Sorry Rebecca couldn't be here with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, we miss Rebecca, and thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.